Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. I'm here to have conversations. Real, honest, authentic conversations. The kind we aren't supposed to have anymore. I interview anyone I find interesting, from left to right to everywhere in between. I work independently in order to have the freedom to say what I believe and speak to whoever I want. Staying independent has allowed me to speak freely and to tell the truth, no matter how unpopular, for many years now, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. We have seen over the last few years how deeply compromised big media is, and how willing mainstream journalists are to twist facts and hide the truth to sell a narrative. I opted out of mainstream media and a traditional career path for a reason. I want to come to my own conclusions and not be compromised by financial, political, ideological, or corporate limitations. I refuse to trade my integrity or my free speech for a paycheck. But that means I need your help. I rely on donors and patrons, so individuals, to support my work so that I can continue to do what I do. If you appreciate the kinds of conversations we're having at The Same Drugs and wish to support my work, a great way to do that is by becoming a subscriber on Patreon, that's patreon.com/MeganMurphy, or on Substack at meganmurphy.ca, where subscribers can be sure not to miss a single episode, can access subscriber-only video content, and engage with the comment section, subscriber-only chats and AMAs, and can keep up with my writing as well. You can also follow the podcast on Spotify and support this podcast directly there by clicking the support button on the Same Drugs podcast page. Thank you so much for supporting Conversations Outside the Algorithm. Today on the show, I am speaking with Helen Roy, a staff writer at The Blaze, the host of Girl Boss Interrupted, and publisher of Ladies Late Rome Journal on Substack. Helen, thank you so much for joining me on this Redhead Supremacist podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Unrecorded was me and Helen discussing how much better redheads are than everyone else.
Oh man, I should ask, do you know Razib? I should ask him about the genetic origins of all that stuff.
I don't think I know him.
He's a geneticist. He's really smart, Razib Khan. Anyway.
I know, yeah, I would be curious too. It is funny though, because I do feel like redheads sort of like fit the stereotype of kind of like fiery and,
yeah,
I guess outgoing, bubbly.
Yeah. Yes,
people,
yes,
would probably say crazy. I would very much disagree with that.
But. No, it's thumos. It's vitality.
Right.
Good.
Right. How are you?
Doing well.
I mean, I've been following you on Twitter for a little bit, but I actually don't know all that much about you. So I'm curious, yeah, if you could just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and who you are.
Sure. So my name is Helen Roy. I am a mom. I'm a Catholic. I'm a wife. I am a writer. I got my start. I studied Chinese in undergrad, and I got my start professionally working for the federal government in DC. And using my degree. And while I was doing that, I was like becoming quite disillusioned with that world. Uh-huh. And so I sort of got in with some Claremont people while I was living up there in DC. Claremont is the big scary right-wing think tank that the New York Times loves to run hit pieces on. but it's just such a great group of people, really, really smart people. And that just like getting to know them, I just started writing like originally kind of pseudonymously. And then now I'm sort of like out, I've come out of the closet and I'm just writing under my own name and writing about things that interest me and politics. And, you know, like originally my political interests were, you know, hinged on a more, I guess you say like national scale, like national security issues, things of that nature. You know, I was like you know, thinking about China, obviously, but then my sort of political conversion happened as I was also going through a personal religious reversion to the faith, and was very much rethinking the role of men and women in a society, and sort of came to the conclusion that all of the problems that we're having on the level of like national security, all these sort of like highbrow problems, kind of trickle up, you could say, or they emanate from some really deep core family issues that I think are really so fundamental. And so the conclusion that I kind of came to is that the biggest national security crisis of our time really has to do with the family and men and women and how we relate to each other. You know, we don't have a nation unless that happens. And if you just even look at the word national or nation, the Latin root is natus, which means to be born. These are things that happen inside the body of a woman because of the activities that happen between men and women, obviously. And so like it is this like such a fundamental issue, and I really enjoy thinking about it. And so yeah, I've just been writing about that ever since. I've been writing about sex and gender and the family and parenthood and raising children and dating, and that's what I'm interested in. Hopefully that wasn't too long-winded.
No, that's perfect. I'm wondering if you were, you know, what's your experience been with feminism? Were you ever identifying with feminism growing up, or were you always sort of critical?
Yeah, you know, I had some like family trauma stuff happening in my early teens and just like through my teens. And when that happened, like when the family kind of fell apart a little bit, I discovered some feminist stuff online, and sort of it kind of distracted me and gave me some purpose and provided a sort of like life narrative, and I would say kind of like a false confidence, but right. One that was kind of probably better than the alternative, which was no confidence. So anyway, I think I was, but really just like a standard order social media feminist, you know, like right. And I'm still fairly young. I'm like 28 years old. So I don't even want to pretend like I've arrived or anything. Like I don't know. This is like I still have a lot of life left to live, and a lot has happened in recent years that is interesting, but I'm still trying to figure all of this out. But yeah, I would say my background with feminism is I was sort of a standard order lib for a little while, and it sort of provided a life script where otherwise there was just kind of a vacuum. And then when I actually went to, when I was living in China, and studying abroad, I was surrounded by, it was a pretty like elite program, and all of my peers were like Ivy League people. And they were so, it was so funny, like in my small Southern conservative school, I was like a token lib. And then when I was in that environment, like I was just like not leftist enough for them, and they were so critical and rude, and I was really like so put off by that. And that was like 2015 era, and so I sort of like began my questioning of the whole narrative, because I was like, wow, these people who like premise their entire political philosophy on being the nice guys are actually such jerks. So anyway, it was kind of a weird personal thing, but yeah, but then I don't know, I would say like I really started to question the philosophy of liberal feminism as such. Yeah, right around that time, like 2016, 2017. It was actually when the transgenderism thing started, because that was just like a bridge too far. It was just such a step into unreality that there was no pretending about that. And I was really personally offended by the way that people talked about Jordan Peterson. This was before he was big, but I was just kind of like aware of him and saw how people were like really trying to ruin his life for refusing to use pronouns. And I was like, you know, for all of my faults, for all of I don't know, belief of BS, I was, I was enough. I had the grace of being enough attached to reality that that offended me. So.
That's interesting. I mean, I remember also being personally offended at how Jordan Peterson was being treated around that was when he started speaking out. I remember it was around 2016 because that's when also I was desperately trying to publish about this, and that sort of just preceded both of us among a few other people speaking against, testifying against Canada's gender identity legislation at the Senate. And I remember listening to an interview that he did on CBC Radio, which is our national public broadcaster, and the interviewee was just so, I didn't really know much about him either at the time. And you know, I sort of went back and forth over the years following as to what, you know, whether or not I liked him or agreed with him on various things or whatever. And of course, I've come to the conclusion that there's some things that I agree with that he says and other things I don't. but she was so rude. She treated him so disrespectfully. Yeah, I felt so defensive of him. I'm curious though, how, you know, how did you end up? So you were sort of surrounded by primarily progressives at your school, is that fair to say? How did you end up being the one who could see through all the gender identity stuff and sort of begin to push back rather than to go along or
Yeah, I
pretend to
don't
go
know.
along?
Yeah, I really don't know. It probably goes back to the original topic of conversation, just being a disagreeable redhead. I was just
Right. You're
like,
like, you all
nah,
think this,
I
not
think so.
me.
It's like, let me just, I'll just, I'm comfortable being different. Like,
Yeah, me too.
yeah, I don't know, maybe just like a little bit of a natural contrarian in me or something. But I also, I mean, honestly, it's just like there, but by the grace of God, go I. I think given any other kind of circumstances or upbringings or whatever it is, like I would have believed the same things and been just as much of a like a red guard about it. That is one thing though, speaking of a red guard, like I do think that my background in Chinese and I had a very close relationship with a Chinese professor who had survived the Cultural Revolution and was a child during the Cultural Revolution. And like my sophomore year of college, I did this philosophy project on grit, the concept of grit, like what makes somebody tough, mental toughness. And I talked to her, and she just shared this really touching story that really kind of changed me, I think, about the communists in China and how horrible they were. She was the daughter of a professor who was publicly beaten and taken away and like put in some sort of like jail facility, but she had to watch her father be publicly defamed and beaten. And then at night, the guards would come, and after her father was taken away, yeah, anyway, the guards came to her home. And she told me that, oh my gosh, it's so upsetting. But she told me the story of how the guards came to her home and she heard them rape her mother. Anyway, I really loved this woman. We were very close. I cry so easily. I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize. I mean, it's
But
horrific. It's
yeah,
horrific to
it
imagine
is.
something like that.
Right. And she was a child at the time she heard this. And so I think I, because of that story, had a particular, and I still do have a particular animosity for communism, for communists.
Yeah.
I've just seen, I think, you know, firsthand how that can hurt a person. It's like very taboo. Like Chinese people are very tough, mentally tough, and just culturally speaking, and don't cry publicly or anything. And like, you know, my teacher was crying about this, and yeah, I think that story really touched me. And so that was like, that might have been, even now that I think back, is like that might have been like maybe an origin point for my whole political thing.
Yeah.
Because that was about a year before I left for China, and that stuck with me. It really did. And so, yeah. Also, I will say, living in China, it was butt ugly. Like, it was a hideous place to live because they had torn down all of the traditional, beautiful artifacts of Chinese culture and
Right.
replaced them with these monstrosities. And that is something that I also feel on a visceral level. I'm an aesthetic person, believe it or not, from my background, but I do appreciate beauty. And yeah, I found that really personally offensive. So.
Yeah, and I mean that's something that we are seeing the progressives or leftists or whatever you want to call them doing today, you know, destroying historical artifacts. I mean, I've always one of the things, I'm from Vancouver, and Vancouver, it like BC, the province that Vancouver is in, is such a beautiful province. Like the outdoors, like the mountains, the oceans, the forests are really beautiful. But the city itself of Vancouver, I think, is so ugly because there's nothing old. It's just all new, and everything that was old, they've destroyed and built, you know, these disgusting, I suppose they're supposed to be architecturally interesting, but I find them ugly and disgusting to look at. Or they're, you know, these huge glass condos, and then of course we see things like the, you know, the climate activists destroying the Mona Lisa with soup.
Right.
You know, there's something about that culture and those politics that are opposed to or uninterested in beauty.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, you're lucky that you were, despite the fact that that was clearly a traumatic story to hear, you're lucky that you were exposed to that because for you, communism wasn't just a theory, you know, it wasn't just
Oh, yeah.
a point of argumentation, which it was for me growing up and for a lot of these leftists in Western countries.
Yeah.
So you're a millennial then, is that right?
No. I was born in 95. I think I am a zillennial, you could say. Like, I don't identify with Gen Z, but I totally identify with like millennial culture too much.
Okay.
But yeah, it feels like one foot in a couple of generations. I don't know. I've always felt older. I've looked 30 since I was 16. I don't it's like I don't know what I am. I like to hang out with people who are Gen X, though.
Okay, interesting. I'm technically Gen X, but I'm right on the very cusp. So I didn't even know what generation I was supposed to be a part of until recently. I was like, I guess, well, technically I'm Gen X, but I always thought of Gen X as older than me. So I suppose I feel similarly to you, except that I never felt older. I think I felt younger. But I mean, I guess I grew up as third wave feminism was beginning in the 90s. I was a teenager in the later 90s. And so my relationship to sex and relationships and men was very much, you know, learned through this feminist, so-called feminist approach. You know, I've always been, since I've been writing about feminism, I've been critical of third wave feminism. I was sort of more interested in second wave feminism or radical feminism. But you know, I learned that you could and should separate sex from emotion. You know, when I was a young woman, I thought I could have sex like men and that that could be empowering. And of course, later I started to question that. And even later, I started to think about how anti-human that is, really.
Yeah.
When were you exposed to those kinds of ideas? I wonder what your process was around learning about how you should approach, you know, sex, men, relationships, and how sort of the mainstream feminist view shaped that for you.
Yeah, I think that that was a powerful narrative that still remains and is still like very, like if you even suggest that there is a component to sexual intercourse that isn't purely physical, it's really an affront to the whole political philosophy. Like that, I think that that is still very much true. And it was very much true as I grew up. There was especially, I think, a moment between like 20, gosh, maybe like 2010 to 2016 or something like that, where you sort of saw, like, I don't know if you ever watched Girls, but
yeah, I did.
Yeah, where that sort of thing was like being it almost had a resurgence. Like I think maybe in like the earlier 2000s, there was, you know, these things sort of come and go in waves. And in the earlier 2000s, there was sort of like a swell in purity culture. And then I don't know if what I'm saying even corresponds to reality, but it's sort of a vibe. Like, but anyway, so yeah, I agree. Like that's totally out there. Yeah, was absolutely inundated with that kind of message as well. I think the best way to understand it though is, and I think the only way that I began to make sense of human sexuality was after I became a Catholic. And that it's kind of complicated because I was like technically baptized, but my parents didn't raise us in the faith. And so it was like a choice made later on when I was like 23 years old. Anyway, yeah, I think that actually, it's not just, so we talk about in the bigger culture, it's like, we try to present it as like, oh, sex and emotions are separate and they can be separated, but it's actually much deeper than that. It's like when we talk about sex, what we actually should be talking about is like the human person. What is the human person and what are we for? So things only started to make sense to me when I sort of left the entire like sex and emotion framing behind, because in disaggregating those things from one another and also treating them like they're the only things, you kind of, both of them are kind of diminished in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate there's a man named Christopher West who does a lot of work around theology of the body, which is a philosophy that was developed by St. John Paul II, which basically gets to that question of what is a human being? What are we for? Well, we are body and soul, and sex has certain ends that are obvious because of natural law. There is the procreative end, like our genitals are for generating human life. That's one, but there's also the unitive end, which is the human aspect of that. And sex is only proper and only makes sense and is only actually fulfilling when both of those aspects of the human person are fully recognized, body and soul. And so like I would say like the we've been operating within this like consent framework for a long time, which really rejects all of those questions, doesn't even confront them, doesn't want to deal with them. It's just do you or do you not want to do something? And the moral question can only boil down to like, I don't know, like what is the thing that libertarians call it? Like the non-aggression principle of non-aggression or something like that. Like you can't hurt anybody. That's the only thing that sort of sanctifies a moral action is not hurting someone. But that's really not enough, especially when it comes to sex. And like, as it turns out in lived reality, like when people are having sex with one another, they need their bodies to be respected and they need their souls to be respected. And so, yeah, ultimately, like that's really what has helped me make sense of it. I think that that is true.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought up the consent issue, because I spent many years trying to kind of get my head around the problem with that model, because, you know, on the left, and, you know, it would libertarians, leftists, feminists, they really, really started to emphasize this message that consent is everything, and consent's the whole question. I think probably, I'm trying to think, you know, probably started around like, I don't know, 2009 or somewhere around there. And it's hard to explain why that's wrong. As, you know, I was a leftist at that time and a feminist, but to me, I just knew that it seemed dangerous and harmful, you know, to just say the only question that matters is consent. And part of the reason I could understand that was because I was looking at things like BDSM, and I'm like, well, so you can consent to abuse, like you can consent to being hurt and degraded, as long as you say yes. And, you know, things like prostitution is fine so long as the woman, or, you know, often girl, people don't like to acknowledge that most women get into prostitution when they're underage, you know, as long as there's consent. And so it didn't even mean she had to want to or not want to. She just had to essentially sign the contract.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I like that you brought that up. And most women in pornography as well were abused as children. As children. Yeah. Most, if you're doing sex work or if you're online, the chances are there was a person that hurt you.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that's another thing that like we never ever acknowledge as a society. Why is it that these people who are doing these things publicly and selling their bodies, why is it that all of them are coming from a place of deep hurt?
Yeah. And what does consent mean in that context? You know, if you're molested as a girl or sexually abused throughout your, you know, for lots of them, their stories. I've listened to and talked to lots of women who've been in porn and prostitution. I was watching this interview the other day, actually on YouTube, with this escort in New York. And it was so strange because the man who was interviewing her was acting like she was this super empowered woman, but her story was just trauma and trauma and trauma and trauma and trauma. You know, her mother rejected her. She was abandoned. She was in the foster care system. She was sexually molested. I think she was maybe she tried to go back to her mom, and then the mom's boyfriend molested her. Yeah. But now she's, you know, she's working for herself, and she's an escort, and she's making all this money, and she's in charge of herself. And there was no critique from the guy. Not that I think he should have been haranguing her over it, but he was treating her like this was like this wonderful thing. And I was like, are you not hearing the same thing I'm hearing here?
Yeah, seriously.
So did you, when you were a teenager, did you feel like porn culture was really pushed on you? Like, you grew up with the internet, which I did not. Oh, that's a major difference between the generations now, of course.
Yeah, I first saw pornography when I was 7 years old at a sleepover.
Oh God.
Yeah. And I think that does really do damage to a person mentally. Maybe I'm revealing too much, but yeah, no, I think it does damage. Like, even if you're not engaging in like sex or whatever, like so many Gen Z people are not, but all of them have been like viewing pornography, or at least have seen it from a very young age. So I think that even, I think the porn question is really a big one. But yeah, it is a problem of saturation.
And do you think that's true, that Gen Z is having a lot less sex than the older generations are? We've been hearing that a lot lately.
I mean, statistically, from what I understand, statistically, that's true. But at the same time, I think that ironically, like, even if people are not physically doing these things, the way that women are presenting themselves are online what we would have said, what we've called 15 years ago, we would have called it like slutty, you know? So it's kind of ironic, right? Like these girls are posting a lot of thirst traps, but not having a lot of sex. So kind of strange there, but I think people are probably having a lot more cyber sex. Yeah.
I noticed that too. And I think that's actually, really important to note that these young women who are posting hypersexualized images of themselves online and are hyper focused on sex and sexuality online, you know, who are perceived to be really sexy, are not actually, you know, sexually empowered themselves. You know, they're either not having very much sex at all, or they're not having enjoyable sex, or they don't feel very good or about or comfortable with their bodies. And I always try to, you know, remind men of that as much as possible. I'm like, this is nothing to do with sex. Like,
yeah,
you turned on when you look at this, but for her, you know, it's not very sexy taking selfies. Like, it doesn't make you feel sexual when you're taking like 100 photos of yourself and then airbrushing them and editing them and posting them so that strange creeps on the internet can like them or make creepy comments about you.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know what you think though about, like, there's been this kind of explosion of men, like, you know, red pilled guys. and of course, you know, like Andrew Tate type guys who are speaking to men, young men, speaking to the manosphere, who've really blown up, become really famous, and a lot of cases made a lot of money by, I think, claiming to empower men, but at the same time, I think teaching kind of disrespect or denigration of women. But I mean, I also don't follow these guys that closely, so I don't know if I'm saying that accurately, but I'm curious to know what you think about that.
Oh yeah. I think that's an understatement. I think that these guys are like, yeah, like very much explicitly preaching the moral and mental inferiority of women. And basically the idea that women are sort of pawns in this life game of making yourself into an alpha for men, which looks like sleeping with a lot of women and, you know, getting money. It's a very rap style philosophy of life and life and lifestyle. And it's about that shallow. But yeah, they've sort of intellectualized it and made this like animalistic kind of bravado thing into a political movement. And yeah, it's just like super degrading for both men and women. I think what's so ironic about the entire thing is that men who subscribe to it, you know, talk pretty openly about how much they hate women. I mean, this is known. This is not controversial. Mm-hmm. But they organize their lives around what makes them sexually appealing to women. They organize their lives around having sex with women. So I think ultimately, like, what does that do to a person? Like, if you imbibe all of this content about hating somebody, but then making that somebody the sort of final arbiter of your worth, that's pretty bad, I think, mentally for somebody to do. And then for just to themselves, you know, like that's a confidence killer. But then it sort of, I think, feeds into the whole thing because you like they talk each other up and you know, whatever, there's a lot of just peacocking. I think that movement is just super disgusting. I will say, in fairness, that I think that men have felt degraded by feminism, by liberal feminism specifically. I think that they have felt like opportunities, specifically, you know, career opportunities, scholarship opportunities, stuff like this, like, you know, when I was applying to school, like there's nothing out there for white men. Like there's just talking about scholarships and stuff like that, you know? And that's just one example of sort of a society-wide hatred and misandry. And so I understand why men would feel kind of put upon by that culture. Well, I just think that the answer is cheap and easy and too easy. And if it's an easy answer, it's probably wrong. And, you know, they just have chosen to sort of inhabit the form of the boogeyman that liberal feminists created in the first place. And so they've just become, they've become the monster, and they think that that's the answer and that's a good thing. And what I'm trying to sort of constantly remind people and constantly remind myself is that you can step outside the frame of the argument. Like there's somebody will posit something like a political thing. Like, okay, so here's the basic thing that's happening with the manosphere. Well, with, so starting with like liberal feminists would say like, okay, Aristotle said man is a rational animal, and men say that women are irrational, so we must be subhuman, right? And I mean, and to be fair, like there were plenty of men who said that throughout history, right? But they took that and ran with it and said, no, women, in order to be more human, women must behave more like men. Women must be physically and economically enabled to be exactly like men. And that's how we achieve liberation. That's what second wave feminists said. Okay, and so now these men are actually accepting that precise framing of men and women's issues. They're saying, to be human is to be a rational animal, and women are not quite rational. So women are subhuman. Right. Okay, so yeah. Totally. Let's run with that. And it's like, I just like what I, like I said, what I love to remind people and love to remind myself is that this is a false dichotomy. Like women's maternity, their physicality and rationality, that is a false dichotomy. You can, and you don't have to choose between one or the other, you know? So, and then that, and that false dichotomy plays itself out in so many ways, like through the mommy wars, you know, like, you know, career women think that they're hyper rational and that stay-at-home moms are something less than that because they're quote unquote not using their brains. And I just think that removing ourselves from that framing entirely is a really good step forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the interesting aspects of this manosphere and this kind of Andrew Tate perspective is that what I've heard them do a lot of late, which I was interested in, is start to criticize pornography and criticize, but also criticize like girls who use OnlyFans, also start talking a lot about body count and how a man doesn't want a woman who slept with tons of guys. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, and you know, those could be fair criticisms, fair conversations to have. But I kept being like, do you think that a woman wants to be in a relationship with a man who slept with a ton of women? Like,
yeah.
Do you think that women, so women should be okay with you guys using porn, but they shouldn't act porny, like they shouldn't perform in those ways? And I mean, I think everybody should be accountable for their own actions. You know, I don't want to perform like a porn star. I don't watch porn. I don't like porn. I think it's disgusting. I think it's bad for your mind, body, and soul. But it's like, okay, you guys have a lot of opinions about these so-called slutty women who are probably really actually just traumatized women, and no criticisms for your own behavior and why those, you know, those girls are behaving in that way because they think that's what you want, or because you've actively told them that's what you want.
Right.
Where is your accountability?
Totally. Yeah. It's a victim mindset fundamentally. And I think a victim mindset, wherever it manifests, whether that's in liberal feminism or the red pill or whatever, is a great way to live a pretty bad life. It's the way that people sort of escape accountability. It's gross, man. It should disgust truly rational people, but
yeah. Well, and yeah. It's also funny because those are the same people who would be criticizing the victim mentality. Like, don't be a victim, be empowered. Oh. But then they're behaving as though they play no part in this man-woman dynamic that has manifested itself these days.
Totally.
So you're married.
Yes. Very married.
What does that mean, very married? For life.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you think about, so in the US, this is what I've read in any case, marriage has declined by 60% since the 70s. And I think there's been a lot of conversations coming from conservatives, coming from the right, around this idea that people are leaving their relationships too casually. They're getting divorced too casually. People aren't taking their marriages or their relationships seriously enough anymore. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I want to say yes and no. So I used to think, so first of all, like the point itself about marriage, I think like marriage is okay. So what does it mean to say marriage is on the decline? Does it mean more people are getting divorced or less people are getting married? I tend to think that I actually think divorce is down, but it's just people are not getting married or they're getting married much later in life. So as for the divorce question, if you isolate for certain factors, divorce rates are actually quite low. Like if you isolate for people who are educated and go to church actually every week, and what's another one, have married parents, then people are, who 90% people just stay married, you know. So that's not, you know, that's good, right? It's not good that any divorces are happening. You know what I mean? Like, you hate to see people's lives blow up, right? Okay. But most of that is happening with people who are, it's not their first time actually, like who are kind of like serial, divorcers. A lot of that was actually older generations too. Like the boomers were the people who have like the third marriages or whatever.
And, right. It's not, I feel like I've met several men who are like, you know, 60 at this point, and it's like, they've been married four times. It's like, what?
It's like,
why do you keep getting married if you're just going to keep ending the marriage?
What could inspire you on the fourth round to say, oh, this will be different.
Yeah.
But anyway, no. Yeah. So millennials are pretty good actually when it comes to like staying married. Millennials, gosh, there was somebody who wrote this book called The All or Nothing Marriage, which was insightful and basically said that like because of the way that our societies have kind of fallen apart, like people who are getting married need more from one another. And that means that when it's good, it's really, really good. But when it's bad, it's kind of horrid because like fundamental needs are not being met. So anyway, it's a complicated topic, right? But I would say, as for, there is that talking point about like, oh, like women file most divorces and women are doing this because they're flighty and this and that. And I'm sure that there is room for that to be true in several circumstances. I know flighty women one flighty woman who has left a marriage because she was flighty, right? Mm-hmm. But I also know men who destroyed their marriage and cheated on their partners serially, and the wife filed for divorce because he wasn't going to do it. So it's like, I mean, women handle a lot of the sort of, the administrative tasks of households. And so it would kind of make sense that women would file more for divorce. I don't think that women are uniquely actually like flighty or unfaithful. In fact, men cheat far more than women do. So I would definitely reject that narrative part of it. And I just think that, honestly, I don't know. I kind of feel like people are, I think the truth about marriage today is that people have a lot of, like I said, people have a lot of needs, social needs that aren't being met because there's no way they could be met by one person. You know, like women need female friendships and men need male friendships. And those are unique experiences. And there's a certain sort of like spiritual poverty that occurs in this loneliness that's just everywhere. And I think when marriage becomes a casualty of that fact, it's really sad. But I don't think it's because people are bad people, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, people are bad people. I kind of vacillate wildly between being like a total misanthrope and being like, you know, people are great.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know. It's kind of complicated.
I know. Some days I'm like, oh, people are good and the world is good. And then some days you look at all the bad things and you're like, oh man, right. People do really horrible stuff. And this does not bode well for my optimism. Totally. But I feel like the people that I know who've gotten divorced, it's not been easy. You know, it's not been an easy decision. It's not been an easy process. And I think that women in particular really hang on for as long as they can until they feel like they have to. And I mean, this is just all my views based on experiences and looking around and what I've seen. So I don't have statistics to back this stuff up, but it seems like, to me, it seems like men are more willing to just kind of like stay in the marriage, but then not change their behaviors, maybe continue to cheat, maybe continue to be disrespectful, maybe continue to be abusive. And the women kind of hang on for as long as they can, but then eventually, yeah, maybe they will be the ones to file the papers. But that's also because they're suffering, or maybe they're more tuned into their suffering in that marriage.
Yeah, and I do think women are probably more emotionally kind of attuned to subtle things in the relationship. And I think that men, I think that in the same way that women are kind of emotionally deadened by the careerism as a lifestyle, I think that men are too, but nobody talks about that. Mm. Like, you know, men were the first people to be torn out of their homes because of like the economic reality of the time. Men were the first who had to go to the factory and do the things, right? So there's like a natural aspect of men that are, that's like a little bit more, I think, potentially, like objective in their orientation toward the world. But also I think there's an additional cultural historical component that has led men to being sort of divorced internally from their emotions and their, and has made them sort of ignorant to their effect on other people sometimes. Mm. And this is true for women too, by the way. It's true for both.
What do you think that, or why do you think that modern relationships fail? Like, what do you think that men do wrong, and what do you think that women do wrong in their relationships that lead to relationships ending or not succeeding?
Yeah. I think that people do not invite God into their relationships. I think that, and I don't want to sound like some like crazy fundamentalist here, but the way that Jordan Peterson,
I wouldn't even know how to do that. I would have no idea to invite God into my relationship.
Well, we can talk about it. But yeah, I think that, okay. So how Jordan Peterson actually describes marriage, I think is very useful. It is this mutual subjugation to an objectively higher good. Mm. And so that's God in a Christian marriage. That is God. He is his plan, his will, and he is the objectively higher good to which both of you submit your hopes, plans, and desires. And so that it's a very simple, simple act of putting the self aside. It's a very, very simple and basic act of humility that when it becomes the foundation of your relationship, I think engenders a willingness to be humble in other ways in your life for the sake of one another. So it's there's a spiritual action happening here, but as always, it's also deeply practical. And it's a sort of, I think, like a reflex, like a moral psychological reflex that maybe you develop when you remind yourself that your relationship, your marriage is not for you, it's for objective truth, goodness, and beauty, you know? And so, and it is for you too. I mean, these things aren't mutually exclusive, but it's just, it sort of takes, I don't know. I think that, like I said, that little act of humility is really important. And also, well, I'll just leave it at that. And I don't know. Do you have any?
I'm wondering what you think. I've been thinking about marriage a lot. I mean, I suppose I've been thinking about marriage a lot for a long time because when I was younger, I was explicitly anti-marriage. Mm-hmm. So I was opposed to marriage from primarily a feminist position. I also didn't care that much about marriage because I didn't want to have kids. So I didn't see the point in being married. And I actually, in the past, now I think I see things differently, but in the past I probably would have thought, you know, like, even if you have kids, why do you need to get married? You know, you can still have your partnership. And so I think I've been exploring the purpose of marriage more lately. Mm. So I'm curious to know what you think about that. You know, what's the point of marriage? Who is marriage for? What is marriage for?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, the Catholic position on marriage is that it is a vocation, and it is a calling. It is something that God has asked you to do in order to get your spouse, to sanctify your spouse, actually. So there's a mutual sanctification that's happening too in marriage. It's in other words, like, people are in relationships with one another in order to make each other better people.
Mm. Do you think that there's any purpose in getting married if you're not planning to have kids and a family? I mean, do you think that the institution of marriage or the tradition of marriage should primarily be focused on family and kids?
Yes, I think primarily I think one should always be open to having children within the context of marriage. But there are plenty of people who have fertility issues. And so it would, like, the next question would obviously be, well, what about people who are married who can't have children? Mm. And so it is more than that too. I mean, I think that is a sort of, like, obvious outcome of marriage and can be an obvious goal in marriage, but and it should be something that people are open to, but it's, you know, in order to get married. But when you're there and it hasn't happened and you know, things of that nature, there's still other things that are happening. You still have a role and helping one another do life. I think the probably the modern, like, secular liberal idea of relationships and marriage is the emotional satisfaction of the individual, emotional sexual satisfaction of the individual. And I don't want to denigrate that, because that's actually important. Like, people's emotional needs are often real and based in reality. And, you know, we are, as I said earlier, we are body and soul. And, so those things are important too, but I think that the willingness to get beyond the desire to be satisfied and like the willingness to get beyond making yourself the objective is important and helpful in order to have a, you know, a long-term happy relationship.
Mm-hmm. So what dating advice do you have for people in the younger generations who I think are, first of all, I think they seem to believe that they're relegated to dating apps, and I think that dating apps are awful, but I don't think that young women are particularly enjoying being on dating apps. Maybe I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but you know, like I feel like I'm hearing, right. I think I'm hearing from young people, men and women alike, that they're like, I can't meet anyone and this sucks. Like, you know, they're either not meeting anyone in real life at all, or they're not meeting matches and they're just sort of stuck in this online swiping that goes nowhere and no one's happy. And I think it's causing them to think really negatively about the other sex on top of that all.
For sure.
I mean, yeah. So what would you suggest? Like, do you have dating advice, like how to meet people, how to go about it, what people are doing wrong, what they should be doing if they're younger and they're trying to meet someone?
Yeah. Man, you know, well, I did meet my husband on Bumble. He was my first Bumble date. Isn't that crazy? Wow. Yeah. So I think that's like lightning in a bottle, you know, that's not something that I can base advice on. but I will say that, I think part of the reason why my husband and I fell in love is because we were both very much on self-improvement journeys. We were really concerned with aligning ourselves with what was objectively true and good and beautiful. You know, truth, beauty, and goodness. That's a really good motto to keep in the back of your mind through life, I think. But so I don't, as for dating advice, I just really feel like it's so primary that people dig deep and be honest with themselves about the ways that they fall short. Mm. And I'm not talking about like, oh, I have like a ridge on my nose that's a little wider than I'd like. You know, that's not self-improvement, that's vanity. I'm talking about, you know, like, oh, like I ghost people, like I'm passive. You know, like I could be brave. I could be way more brave in my honesty, in my needs in relationships or whatever, not even just my needs, or just like something objectively wrong happened in a relationship. You let that thing happen. You don't say anything. No, actually, no, it would have been morally good for you to speak up, you know? And I think that a lot of people, I don't know. I just think that focusing, like getting back to those basic things and really, really trying to be honest with yourself and just align yourself in that way is going to help you see more clearly in terms of who you want to be with and the precise kind of person that you want to be with. And then when a particular person comes by, you're going to be able to connect with them. Rather than sort of viewing them as a commodity, like so many people in the dating world do now, view each other as commodities because that's how we treat each other sexually and otherwise. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that's probably my best advice. It's about dating. It has nothing to do with dating.
Do you think people should get off dating apps, or do you think that they can be good for some people in terms of meeting partners, potential partners?
I think they can be good, but I think, I don't know, a little bit of a hot take I have on that is that you should apply some game theory and differentiate yourself. Like, I think a lot of people go to the dating apps and they think, I'm going to make myself maximally appealing and I'm not going to say anything controversial and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to do anything edgy or whatever. And that by sort of, by doing that, like, yes, you have all the options of in the world, but like, the investment isn't there. Whereas if you kind of like limit your options a little bit in your bio by putting yourself out there, I mean, not in a way that makes you like completely vulnerable to, you know, psychos, but I'll give you an example. My husband's bio on Bumble was dank meme connoisseur. That was it. And I thought that was hilarious. So, but I only thought that was hilarious because I was like an extremely online weirdo. But it works. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like doing that. If you're going to be on the apps, you have to be a little bit more creative. Yeah.
Okay. One more question. Do you think that there's a swing from left to right in the US? I mean, it seems it sort of seems like it just swings back and forth over and over again. And it's hard to really assess what is really going on versus what we're seeing on social media. But do you think that, you know, everything that the left has done has just pushed so many people so far that there's a swing right?
Yeah. Oh, it's hard to say. I want to say, yeah, I think that, I think that there's something really true in the Trump moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true in 2015. I think it was like the silent majority, you know, a lot of people really fed up and nobody kind of in the culture, like the television culture and all that, like, it's not even acknowledged that these people are real. Now, since then, these people have been represented as evil. And I think that's because that doesn't jive with reality. It's probably made even more people, out of frustration, become, you know, right wing, or what we call right wing. And I don't know, like you said, it's really a lot of back and forth, but and as of right now, you know, February 2024, the economy is in shambles. And I think people are really fed up with Biden and really fed up with like the demons of unreality represented by the Democratic Party and their insistence that grown men be in the same bathroom as little girls. You know, I think that like stuff like that, like it does not jive with reality. Like they really are pushing things that are, they've jumped the shark, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now the question though is like, okay, so I'm coming from the position now that people are clear thinking and sort of offended by lies. I think a lot of people are, but the question remains like how many people are simply not concerned with the truth and are more interested in being socially accepted and mm-hmm. the advancement of their careers and money. That's a huge issue. That was the original thing that really blackpilled me when I was working for the government, because nobody gave a blank about, well, I shouldn't say that. I'll just say people were very concerned with their careers.
Yeah.
And I think that that's true everywhere. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of problems. There's a lot of problems. I think the biggest problem is that people lie. We lie and we lie and we lie about the nature of reality. And I hope that people are willing to push back against the lies, no matter where they come from, because there are people lying who present themselves as right wing at this point. Andrew Tate's life philosophy is based on a lie about human nature. And so, and he's the type who is speaking my language in a certain sense by saying like, well, I just care about the truth and they can't handle the truth.
Yeah.
So it gets very messy. It's like an onion. I don't know. It's very complicated, but that's why, you know, I don't know. That's why I think that people have to. Oh, I remember the thing I was going to say. The other reason why it's important to like invite God into your relationship is because of gratitude. Is because if you can, at the end of every day, get on your knees and thank God that you survived, that you have food in your belly,
right,
and somebody who loves you and a warm bed to sleep in, and just remind yourself every day of that fact, your life is just going to be better, period. You're going to be able to look past your partner's flaws. And anyway, the reason that I think that just came to mind is that I like talking about politics, like how do you orient yourself in this, you know, crap storm of lies coming from all directions? I really think just like really trying to get back to basics and having gratitude for your life and praying actually for the willingness to be honest and the ability to see clearly, you know, I don't know, just humility has this way of clearing out a lot of the mental funk that sort of calcifies and blinds us and encourages us to believe things that aren't true. So,
well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for talking with me today and for sharing your thoughts on all of this. I really appreciate it. Can you let us know how we can find you online?
Sure. Yes. I am at, what's my handle on Twitter? Not me. Just
let me see.
For so many years.
It's Helen of Roy.
Yeah. Helen underscore of underscore Roy. That's my very unfortunate historical analog. But, yeah, Helen underscore of underscore Roy on Twitter. And also I write Ladies Late Rome Journal on Substack, which is frequently linked to my column at The Blaze. I work for The Blaze Media. So yeah, you can follow me on all of those. My link tree is in my Twitter, so it's pretty easy to access and figure it all out.
Awesome. And I'll link to all that stuff in the show notes. Thank you so much again. It was great to meet you.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm Megan Murphy, host of The Same Drugs. Thank you for tuning in. I produce and host this podcast all by myself and rely on individual donors to sustain my work. This is all me and you, the listener. If you want to keep episodes free as well as free thinking, please consider signing up on Patreon at patreon.com/Megan Murphy, becoming a paid subscriber on Substack at www.meganmurphy.ca, or donating directly to support this podcast via PayPal at paypal.me/thesamedrugs. Another really great, really easy way to support this podcast is by clicking that follow button over on Spotify on The Same Drugs podcast page. Every little bit counts and ensures I can stay independent. Thank you so much for supporting conversations outside the algorithm.